Welcome to the Public Morality. When I wrote my book, 1963, The Year of Hope and Hostility, I had the pleasure to interview President Kennedy's noted speechwriter, Ted Sorensen. I asked Mr. Sorensen to share his thoughts about June 11, 1963. That was the day that the Buddhist monk set himself on fire in the streets of Saigon, which was the first indication the country known as Vietnam was becoming a problem. Several hours later, Alabama Governor George Wallace stood in front of the University of Alabama to ceremoniously block two Negro students, Vivian Malone and James Hood, from admittance. Several hours later, President Kennedy spoke to the nation about civil rights, elevating it to a moral issue. And then 2 hours after that, NAACP Director Medgar Evers was assassinated. Sorensen then responded to me by saying, "All that occurred on one day?" Well, it did happen on one day, and it's one of the most transformational days of the 20th century. Joining me to discuss this monumental day in 20th century American history is someone we've wanted to have on the Public Morality for some time, Professor Ellen Fitzpatrick. Professor Fitzpatrick is a noted historian at the University of Hampshire and author of 8 books, including Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation. Professor Ellen Fitzpatrick, welcome to the Public Morality.
Byron, it's nice to be here.
How is it, in your view, that when we look at the events on June 11th, 1963, they're transformational, but they've largely remained under the radar in terms of all this happening within a 24-hour period. Any thoughts about how that happened?
Well, it was a very eventful time in the Kennedy presidency, and really when you pause to think about all of these things converging at once, they were really a product of longer term tensions and problems that Kennedy was facing in this period and that the nation was really dealing with. So you're seeing, of course, the ongoing difficulty in Vietnam and the trouble that Kennedy felt the Diem regime presented to him in Vietnam. So when the Buddhist monk immolated himself on the streets of Saigon, and it was captured by an American photographer, that really spoke to deeper problems that had been really building over a longer period of time, of course. Mm-hmm. And of course, the civil rights speech that Kennedy would give that evening, that had been preceded by the confrontation with George Wallace, the murder of Medgar Evers at midnight, all of those events spoke to the growing tensions in the civil rights movement, the struggle for racial equality that had been, as you know, years, decades, centuries in the making. So it is a dramatic convergence, but of course, the difficulty is much deeper, and history can be like that, you know, that in what's the expression in the Bible and in the twinkling of an eye that life can change.
Right. You said that. I was thinking when I did my book on 63, the first person I interviewed was Ted Sorensen. And I posed a similar question to him about June 11th, 1963, and his response to me was, "Did all that happen on the same day?" So it sort of goes to your point. I mean, so much was going on that even the people who were intimately involved didn't realize in hindsight that it all happened, you know, in a 24-hour period.
Yes, that's true.
And so you make another point that I want to touch upon. You said that these things, I mean, although they converge on a single day, they are years, decades in the making. I mean, we could probably, the timeline for Vietnam becoming a quagmire probably started in 1945 when the French were allowed to go back in and colonize Indochina region again. So these things didn't just happen, you know, at once. I mean, they're decades in the making.
Yeah, and I think particularly in the case of the Buddhist protests that led to this act of revolutionary suicide on the part of this Buddhist monk, and that was part of a larger demonstration, I think, of 300 monks and nuns in the streets of Saigon, The Diem regime was very worried that the Buddhists were somehow supporting the Viet Cong or harboring them, were dissidents, were troublemakers from the point of view of Diem. And so there was a very harsh attempt to suppress their religion. And this was a Buddhist majority country, not a great idea to take this approach, needless to say. But by the time this happened, Kennedy had already become very frustrated, and the American foreign policy establishment in the Kennedy administration, very frustrated with this Diem regime. And of course, by the by August, Kennedy was approving measures that the CIA would take to support a coup d'etat that would overthrow Diem in November. He would be murdered just weeks before President Kennedy himself was murdered. Mm-hmm. So both the prologue and the epilogue extend beyond that day, but the day, as you rightly point out, you know, dramatic.
On that, staying with the Buddhist monk for right now. On that piece, I recall that in October of 63, President Kennedy called Arthur Sulzberg of the New York Times and was trying to get David Halberstam removed from that region because he didn't like the coverage that Halberstam had been writing about Vietnam. So to your point, it was really starting to be. It was starting to be a bigger mess than it was on anybody's radar, maybe except for the Kennedy administration itself.
It was, and you know, by that time, by June, and certainly by the end of the Kennedy administration, there were already some 16,000 so-called American advisors in Vietnam. So there was the ongoing escalation that had occurred of a growing effort on the part of the United States to try to assist the South Vietnamese government to keep it in power and to prevent both the North Vietnam and the Viet Cong from really pursuing their nationalist agenda and the overthrow, of course, of Diem in the process. So all of this was a long time in the making, as you point out, Kennedy's frustration growing, and like the presidents that would succeed him, never very happy with coverage of this by the press. And Halberstam, of course, was way ahead of the curve in writing about it.
Professor Fitzpatrick, can you cite a president who was completely pleased with the press coverage that he received? Does he exist? Did that president exist?
I can't, but you know what's interesting about Kennedy in this regard is that he was an avid follower of the news, and he had a very good rapport with reporters. And he also, as much as he criticized it, there's a wonderful interview that he did that I've seen in which he talks about feeling that he was very much advantaged over Khrushchev in that having a free press was absolutely vital to the workings of the American presidency and to American democracy, because otherwise the president is insulated from really understanding and hearing appropriate criticism, questions, searching, you know, interrogations, really, and that it is an important element of a democratic society. So in fact, he didn't appreciate criticism like all presidents, but he vigorously defended the importance of it. And, you know, add to that, certainly the Kennedy's brothers attempted to control the news, as many presidents and their staff have. So, guilty as charged on the final, but at least he held up the ideal of it.
Right. One of the things I find interesting about President Kennedy and Vietnam, for all of his skills, especially, he comes into office with a preference for foreign affairs. Vietnam is sort of this lingering question mark on the Kennedy resume, and I certainly don't want to sound like an apologist for Johnson, who rightfully deserves the criticism that he's received in his handling of Vietnam. But as we talked earlier, this was decades in the making, and it's the area that you would think that John Kennedy, had this real strength. When he was in Vienna, he told Scotty Retson after the meeting with Khrushchev that he's got to show some strength in Vietnam's space. So how was it that he sort of missed the ball, if you will, and so this Buddhist monk self-immolation sort of catches him off guard? Any thoughts about that?
I'm not sure that it caught him off guard as much as he, like the rest of the world, found it a shocking, it was a shocking photograph, and it was beamed around the world. There are those images that, similar to the way that we're focusing on this day, this sort of liminal moment when things are crystallized. And another such moment was the photograph of the dogs being turned mm-hmm. on civil rights demonstrators. Seeing that man having a police dog biting him and having that on the front page of the New York Times. Those moments produce in Kennedy, as in all the rest of us sentient people, a response that, crystallizes things. So in this case, I think the sort of repression and brutality of the Diem regime, and more importantly, the terrible publicity that these events generated how do you win the hearts and minds of your citizenry when, you have this kind of horror being broadcast around the world. Kennedy was shocked by it, but by the instantaneous image. But he was well aware of the problems in Diem's government, and his administration at that time was already trying to figure out, how do we get this guy to do what we want, or how do we get rid of him? Mm-hmm. And in the end, they chose the latter.
I think one of the things that hurt Lyndon Johnson in the aftermath of Vietnam is, I like to say, that television got to Birmingham before it got to Saigon. And once television got to Saigon, which 66, 67, the narrative, changed. Talk about, in a larger sense, talk about, if you would, the sort of the role of television and its impact and influence on June 11th.
The television really comes of, Kennedy's the first television president, as you point out in your book. And so it's been said, if the gods had conspired, could they have picked a better person to be the first television president? He had a glamorous wife, adorable children, a handsome, articulate man, very, very charming. And suddenly, we're seeing a lot more of the president. We're seeing more of our wars. We're seeing more of the violence and the tensions within the society. We're becoming, this is a game changer. And the Kennedy-Nixon debates in the 1960 election, of course, kind of kick the whole thing off. When you think about the fact, imagine that people had never heard Abraham Lincoln's voice, or, how would Lincoln have come across on television? Had the Lincoln-Douglas debates, let's say, been televised, how would Lincoln have come across, our previous presidents, how would they have fared? Would they have been elected with this kind of glare? we're living with the consequences of that sea change that occurs and that's ushered in this period. And of course, the exposure that Americans had to the war in Vietnam and the dailiness, the relentlessness of the embedded reporters really showing what was happening eventually, you know, helps to turn the tide of public opinion in terms of the war. And Lyndon Johnson, of course, has to live with that, those consequences.
When we look back, I've talked to a number of Kennedy disciples, most notable, of course, being Ted Sorensen. And they all are beholden to the belief that had Kennedy been reelected in 64, he would have pulled out of Vietnam. And I wonder, from your perspective as a historian, given the climate, the Cold War climate that we're in, would it have been that easy just to pull out or do, you know, the threats of being soft on communism, would those have lingered had Kennedy did something that dramatic?
Well, you know, Byron, the interesting thing there is that, of course, we're never going to know. But Kennedy gave this interview with Walter Cronkite in, I think, October of 63.
It was actually September. It was on Labor Day.
In which he talks about, and that's been used by people on both sides of this question as evidence of what Kennedy would or wouldn't have done. Because he says both things. He says, those people who say that we should pull out of Vietnam are completely wrong. But he also says in it that in the final analysis, it's their war, and they're going to have to win it or they will lose it. We can help them. We can provide assistance. And in terms of Kennedy, I think that he did, in fact, and what gives rise to the ongoing debate is that although these advisors were doing a lot more than advising, he did not take the step that Lyndon Johnson took in March of 1965 of deploying combat troops. Once that happens, it's amazing how fast the escalation occurs because it is, you know, we're up to 500,000 soldiers, you know, as we get into the later 1960s, and with the rising casualties that go along with those deployments and the increased combat. So that is a line that Kennedy did not cross. Mm-hmm. And so whether he would have crossed it, we're just never going to know. We do know that Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon were all working within a certain Cold War paradigm that they genuinely believed in, I think, and that if you accepted the dictates of containment and the importance of containing communism, as all of those presidents did, there was a logic to them in the moment to the increasing involvement in Vietnam. So we will never know what Kennedy would have done. There are signs that he was already deeply skeptical. And I think Fred Lagavulin, the historian, is quite persuasive on this point in his argument that he does not think Kennedy would have taken it to the degree that Johnson did, but we won't know. Right. We'll never know.
Right. And I guess one of the sad things in critiquing Johnson, a lot of that escalation occurred after McNamara has a meeting with Johnson that basically says this war is not winnable by any metric we define war, and then the escalation happens, so which makes Vietnam even more tragic and immoral in my view. Professor Fitzpatrick, let's move now to George Wallace in the schoolhouse door, and when Wallace stands physically in front of the door at the University of Alabama, and it was essentially a staged event they had planned in advance, that
it was
Vivian Malone and James Hood would go through a different door so Wallace could save face. So now we're gonna have a little fun with you. I'm gonna ask you to speculate. And instead of John F. Kennedy as president, how do you think that whole scene works out? Same players, with the exception Lyndon Johnson's president. Does Wallace get to save face in the same way?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yes, I think that Johnson would have completely understood, don't you? The need for this, segregationist. I mean, Johnson was far more familiar than JFK was with the type of powerful and seeking to be more powerful Southern Democratic governor who had to save face and to stand up to his boasts that he had made in his inaugural address. This is Wallace, of course, segregation now, segregation forever, right?
Right.
So this was a face-saving operation for Wallace, who had no desire to have a repeat of what had happened at Ole Miss. They didn't want a riot in Tuscaloosa either. Wallace continued to insist on his stance that the federal government and the judiciary itself had no right to tell the state of Alabama what to do. And, they're using Civil War vintage theories of interposition and nullification.
Right.
To sustain this. And this is 1963. So Nick Katzenbach, plays the game, and they allow him to stand there and condemn this illegal action by the federal government. And then the students attend. But nonetheless, it's worth pausing on the courage of these young people who really these were amazingly, for such young people, so poised and courageous, to what may have been a stunt for Wallace could have cost them their lives.
One thing I would say that I certainly take your point. I totally agree with you that they probably would have turned out very similar. Just having read all of Robert Carroll's books on Johnson, I just can't help but believe that he would exact some pound of flesh from Wallace behind the scenes. He would have gotten something else out of the deal. That just seems like the way that Johnson would have operated.
Yeah. Well, he would have. I would have loved to have listened to the tapes, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely.
What was going on behind the scenes? Because I think Lyndon Johnson had a very, very keen understanding of these. He was himself a product of the Democratic Party in the South, and was in pushing forward on civil rights. Knew very, very well what he was up against.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with noted historian Ellen Fitzpatrick about the events of June 11th, 1963. And Professor Fitzpatrick, I often describe the World Wars I and II as one war with a really poorly constructed halftime. And from your perspective as a historian, in a similar vein, when we look at the Kennedy and Johnson years, was it one presidency that highlighted in very glaring fashions both the strengths and weaknesses of two men?
I think that they, yes, both of them had very different strengths. And yet they were at one on a critical way of thinking about the presidency. And that was the sense that it was imperative to use the powers of the presidency to try to redress what they, as people that had really, young men that had really been greatly influenced by Franklin Roosevelt, by living through the events of the early 20th century, to really try to redress the inequalities that existed in American society, to try to really look at problems that continue to bedevil our society today. They had a very affirmative view of the way in which the federal government could, in fact, overcome these differences and leadership, I should say, in the federal government, and really make a difference in the lives of all Americans by enacting broad-scale reforms of the kind that FDR did during the Depression, but this is happening in a time of prosperity for most Americans. So it's idealistic, it's optimistic, it's an expansive view of what government can do. And of course, they, although they had great opposition from conservatives within their own party, they also had substantial majorities to deal with in Congress. And Johnson had just a remarkable record of achievement. Really very tragic that his presidency was, ultimately would be judged, his legacy in the Vietnam War would so overshadow that.
The Kennedy's civil rights speech that night, where do you rank it in the Kennedy highlight reel?
I rank it high in the reel of United States history in the 20th century. I rank it very, very high. I think it was a remarkable moment, and I think it's one that is really worth revisiting at this moment in the life of our nation, because Kennedy really becomes the first president in American history to condemn segregation as a moral wrong, to say, you know, we face a moral crisis as a nation. And no president, even Truman, who had desegregated the armed services, and Eisenhower sending troops to Little Rock to ensure the integration of Central High, or after the Brown decision. No president ever gave a speech like the speech that John F. Kennedy gave that night, in which he said, you know, a revolution is at hand. And it's a remarkable speech, I think. I wish that we had today, we would see, obviously, that speech doesn't need to be given again, at least word for word, although its continued relevance is rather depressing a half a century later. Having a president sit down and talk to the American people, white and black, across all parts of the country, across all lines, and saying, you know, this is an old story. 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, and yet their heirs, their sons, are not fully free. It was a remarkable thing that, of course, should have happened much earlier. But I think it's an extremely important moment. And you wish for the kind of moral leadership that it was too late in coming. You know, Kennedy's been criticized rightfully for that, but it did come on that day in June, and it's a powerful speech even today to read and hear.
One of the things about that speech where I don't think John Kennedy gets enough credit. If you look at John Kennedy circa January 1963, and the same one that gives that speech on the evening of June 11th, as you well know, that speech wasn't complete. And if anyone watches it on YouTube, the last, say, 20% of that speech, he's just sort of winging it. And so you,
yes.
And so the things that he's saying, I mean, that's when you find out what's really in a person. I mean, it wasn't like he was just repeating Ted Sorensen's words. I mean, I think that to me is what makes that speech just so gripping. Your thoughts?
Yes, I agree. The part of it was he delivered extemporaneously, which is pretty hard to imagine in these days of teleprompters and, you know, the sort of blow-dried, media massaged presentations that the public is so often exposed to from our officials. It was the sincerity, I think, was very clear. And, you know, Ted Sorensen could write some pretty good words. I was thinking about this earlier today, but it was the passion and the, the verve with which Kennedy delivered it, which, you know, I don't think in that case, you could fake sincerity. He meant it. He clearly meant it. And I think he was also reaching out to whites to whom he knew this was unwelcome news. You know, those who, you know, he said, you may not, essentially he was saying, you may not like it, but it's here. We're at this moment. You know, the pendulum has swung and we need to move forward as a country and do the right thing. And I think it's a remarkable speech.
You know, when you look at the Kennedy years, probably prior to that moment, the biggest criticism, certainly one emanating from civil rights community, would probably have been Kennedy's unwillingness to risk something, to really, you know, move from the middle and really take a stand. And I think that night he sort of swung the pendulum, as you said, and he was willing to risk something. And I think when presidents risk something, I think that's where we look at them as great presidents. Lincoln risking something, FDR risking something. And Kennedy, I'm not saying Kennedy's a great president or a bad president, I'm saying, but he was, in that moment, he was willing to risk something. And I think the Kennedy presidency really sort of takes off after that.
Well, the interesting thing about this, Byron, is that I think what you're seeing there, the political risk aside, it's a demonstration of moral leadership. He presented it as a moral issue. And so when you define something as a moral issue, you're saying this is right and this is wrong. And he put himself on the side of the civil rights movement at that moment, saying this is right and what's happened has been wrong. And so there was really no going back from that point. There was no way of trying to sort of thread the needle and say there are good people on both sides, right? He wasn't saying that. He wasn't condemning individuals, but he wasn't saying there are two sides to the question. He was saying there really aren't. There's one side. And, you know, yes, there's a history in which it's embedded, but there's a choice here. And it's been made for us by our historical moment. And he landed there. And that is a really powerful thing when that happens. And I fear we don't see enough of it. I would add here, too, that I think that it demonstrates that the president's posture and presentation matters a lot more than we might have thought. You know, people say, oh, well, anyone can give a speech. It's just rhetoric. Yeah, well, we've seen what rhetoric in the opposite direction can produce as well. And so these trappings of the presidency, of speaking in a way that provides moral leadership, is very interesting. It's interesting, so much attention has been placed on Kennedy's private life and the immorality of his behavior, you know, as a husband, or, you know, I make no excuses for Kennedy in this regard, but this is a moment of moral political leadership that I think that we have much to learn from.
Well, to your point, I mean, as we're talking about, as shortly after Kennedy gives that speech, NAACP Director Medgar Evers is assassinated, and at the burial at Arlington, he doesn't attend, but he sends Robert Kennedy, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, to attend the burial, and then he invites Mary Lee Evans and her children for a photo op, and he sits and talks with them. I don't think John Kennedy in January of 63 does that, let alone 1960s. So that whole evolution in that moral leadership wasn't just that night, but we see him taking a side. Here's where I stand on this issue.
Yes, and I think he also understood by them by that point. And I think that events in Birmingham in the spring were critical to this, that he was extremely concerned about the violence and the extremism of the opposition that was being evoked by King and the increasingly aggressive civil rights activism, which was designed to highlight the issues, and he saw the response to that. And, you know, they still were not super enthusiastic about the March on Washington, for instance. They, both Kennedy brothers, were, you know, feeling like this was potentially a dangerous thing. They were worried about violence breaking out and that would hurt the civil rights legislation. So it wasn't as if they suddenly, you know, put themselves at the front of the barricades. You know, they were dragged there. They were dragged there. But, you know, this is about rising to one's historical moment, you know, which King himself had done. And during the Montgomery bus boycott, when he was asked to, you know, have his church be used as a place to organize. He was a young man at that point. He had just arrived, and he was like, you know, let me think about that. He made the right decision. And the rest is history, as they say.
And then you also had, you know, and just speaking about in the aftermath of the assassination of Medgar Evers, then you had some unsung heroes such as John Dorah of the Kennedy administration, a guy who literally put himself mm-hmm. between the Jackson police, you know, and the mob. And it doesn't, as I read those accounts, it doesn't seem like the mob was very interested in being nonviolent. So it's sort of Kennedy's ethos sort of filters down, so people are embracing it who are literally standing, you know, in the middle on the front lines. They're willing to barricade themselves. And he probably prevented untold numbers of violence and mayhem.
Yes, it's just a very, very dramatic story of people really pushing hard against, you know, against wrongs that were institutionalized and that had a long history and that did not give way easily. It was a struggle. And, you know, there are many sort of unsung heroes, I think, in that story. Mm-hmm. No question about that.
You know, one of the things is just going back to Kennedy for a moment, specifically when we look at this month of June. Not only, you know, you mentioned we talked about the civil rights speech already. That was June 11th. Just the day before, was the American University peace speech. And then 2 weeks after that,
yes.
Ich bin Berliner. Has any president ever had a month of memorable oratory like that? I mean, I don't recall of anybody who's had just a meaningful oratory.
I know, it's really amazing when you think that it's also the last months of Kennedy's life. I think that I read, if I'm recalling this correctly, when he leaves Berlin and he is saying, we'll never have to one of his advisors, we'll never have another day like this in our lives, you know. All those events of that early the spring and the summer, and then into the fall. Kennedy came to Amherst College in October. I was 11 years old. I saw Kennedy that day. It was I was one person in a crowd of a few thousand people at the groundbreaking of the Robert Frost Library, and he was dead a month later. And so these are the final months of Kennedy's life, and they were certainly very, very full. And the historic nature of them, you do feel as if he was really coming into his own as president in those months, and that he had learned through those disastrous early months, and the first year was rocky, to say the least.
Well, one could make the argument that 1961 is arguably the worst foreign policy first year for any 20th century president, and then now look at where we are now by June 11, 1963. So there's definitely a learning curve.
He learned, yes, he learned, and he was young. And there was a lot going on. There was a lot going on, as there is for every president. I mean, you look at what President Biden is facing right now. And, it's a very, very difficult job, to say the very least. The responsibilities are enormous.
When we think of this day that we've been talking about, June 11th, is it one of the key data points in understanding the Kennedy presidency? Does it have any lasting significance, or is it just a day that a couple nerds like you and I just got together to talk about? How would you define it?
I would say that, Byron, it just crystallized the sort of key tensions that our country was facing at that moment in time. The civil rights struggle that finally breaks through to the point that we have a president of the United States willing to address the nation and to say, a revolution is at hand. We're, our country needs to change and will change. And I will, he's committing himself to trying to make that happen by introducing civil rights legislation. And certainly we see the foreshadowing of the ongoing agonies of Vietnam, which will cost, at that point, 16,000 advisors in Vietnam, and that by the end of that war, there'll be over 58,000 American soldiers dead, many, many Vietnamese. And so we're seeing the foreshadowing of that. So I think it crystallizes a moment in time.
What about the day itself, for just any lessons? Does it offer any lessons for us in the present moment that we might sort of take a page from June 11th in order to move forward, or are we just in a different time?
No, I feel teaching about this period this fall, I was teaching a survey of American history that went from Reconstruction to the present. And I've been teaching for over 40 years. And what I couldn't believe in teaching this course this time was how easy it was to explain these tensions to the current generation of students, given the salience today of these issues. So talking about the tensions of Reconstruction and the effort to try to institutionalize rights for all of our citizens and to overcome the legacies of slavery and the violence and resistance and difficulties that engendered, as well as the courageous efforts to try to keep progress moving forward. I didn't have to work very hard to explain this history to my students. It all felt very current. And I think in a lot of ways that June 11 of 63 feels all too current in our country today. So I say, you know, you can look at it two ways, which is we haven't come too far, or in fact, I think we have made tremendous progress, but also to see the opportunity to rise to the historical moment and keep change moving ahead.
Professor Ellen Fitzpatrick, University of New Hampshire, thank you so much. It has been an honor to be in conversation with you on the Public Morality.
My pleasure, Byron. Thank you for inviting me.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you receive your podcasts. Once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WJAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast the Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. In the words of Martin Luther King, we may have come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.